Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So today's the big day that the union Unite will be announcing who they are backing for the Labour leadership contest. Katie, we're expecting to hear this a bit later today, but presumably is Rebecca Long Bailey.
If Unite don't back Rebecca Long Bailey, that would be a very big surprise. It'll raise questions about how far Rebecca Long Bailey can really go in this contest. And it will probably mean you get another podcast today. But I think in the meantime, because we're not expecting this result till early evening, the thing to look out for is one thing that's being discussed is there could be an endorsement for Rebecca Long Bailey, but saying where second preference votes should go. So as we've said previously on this podcast, it's a preferential voting system. Once you get to the membership stage, you don't just say who you want to win, you say your second choice. So there is a chance that Unite could say, we want Rebecca Long Bailey to win, but we think your second choice ought to be Lisa Nandy. There's a sense that it's not going to be Keir Starmer. So I think that's an interesting one, because the Lisa Nandy view of the way that she could potentially win is through second preference votes. I still think it looks very uphill for Lisa Nandy. I think one of the interesting things to look out for in this Labour leadership contest is the CLP nominations. Now, at the moment, Emily Thornberry's struggling, and we don't actually expect a single candidate to get through to the membership stage on CLP nominations alone, because you have three candidates who look like as though they will do that with union nominations and affiliate groups. Two already have, Keir Starmer, Lisa Nandy. We expect Rebecca Long Bailey to get there, and Emily Thornberry just isn't making the numbers up. But if you look at previous Labour leadership contests, the point of speaking to figures in Labour where they thought that Jeremy Corbyn actually had a very good chance of winning was when all the CLP nominations started flooding in for Jeremy Corbyn. Now, Keir Starmer is way ahead on CLP nominations over any other candidate so far. I think we've still got lots to come in. I think he is in the 30s, whereas others are in single figures on CLP nominations. So I think there's actually a clear indication that the YouGov polls, which of Labour members, which keep giving Keir Starmer the lead, are potentially onto something here. I still think when you're seeing Lisa Nandy picking up some Rebecca Long Bailey, but it's the fact that Keir Starmer's so far ahead. And I was struck having a few conversations yesterday with figures in Labour, whether it's central office or working on campaigns. You do get the sense that they are almost writing this off as a done thing in terms of Keir Starmer being the winner and Angela Rayner being the deputy leader. Now, I don't think they would bet their entire life savings on that outcome, but the way people are talking is ultimately, and then what will they do once they're in it? It doesn't feel at the moment that this is a contest that has that much of an ability to move, but we still have all the way until April and all the podcasts until then.
Lucky you, listeners. James, this preferential voting system obviously only matters if none of the candidates reach enough first preference votes over 50%, but Keir Starmer looks like he might just win it on the first round.
Yeah, you could say that the Times looked at their YouGov polling and they basically found that if you reallocated Jess Phillips' second preference, that takes Keir Starmer over 50% already. I'm a tiny bit sceptical of that, in that I think Lisa Nandy is probably not growing fast enough, but it's probably kind of growing in terms of support. I think that generally, you know, her media appearances are helping her, not hurting her. But I think Katie's analysis is right. When you look at the data right now, it's quite hard to not see how it is Keir Starmer. Indeed, you know, Lisa Nandy needs to clearly overtake Rebecca Long Bailey if there is to be any, because I don't think Rebecca Long Bailey can win it on second prefs, right? So, you know, while Lisa Nandy would have a better chance, but Rebecca Long Bailey is quite, you know, if she gets the Unite endorsement, I think it's likely that she will. It's just structurally quite hard to see how that happens. Also, the other thing as well, sorry, the ballot papers go out next month, and one of the things we know about postal ballots is that people normally return them straight away. So although we say that this contest goes on, the ballot doesn't close till April 2nd, it's not like a general election where, you know, on polling day, the vast majority of people go and vote. Most people will have returned their postal ballot long before April the 2nd, which is a problem for Lisa Nandy because, you know, if you look at this, you know, you look at when Keir Starmer's agreed to do his Andrew Neil interview. You know, he's agreed to do his Andrew Neil interview in mid-March. Other campaigns are quick to point out that by that point, most people in this contest will have voted, you know. And again, all these things suggest that the Starmer campaign are quite happy with where things are going, you know, and they kind of know what they're doing.
Mm.
And I think also, if you look at how Keir Starmer has devised his campaign, it has something for everyone in the Labour Party. He's essentially prepared to embrace a lot of the Corbynite domestic policy agenda. He obviously was the person who fought for Remain, for the more Remainy inclined members. And then there's this other kind of sense, that just a kind of sense that it's kind of his turn. Now, I think he will make British politics look a bit different, because I struggle to see how Keir Starmer, you know, turns things around for Labour in Blythe Valley or Lee or Wrexham. But I can see how he could squeeze the Liberal Democrats down even further. And so I think this is an interesting question about which way British politics is going. And ultimately, this is a generational shift. I'm not suggesting this is going to change the result of the next general election, but there is an interesting question here about whether Labour are going to start pursuing essentially a southern strategy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and whether you could get to a point where places that we never would have thought of as being places where Labour might win, so for example, cities of London and Westminster, become, you know, Labour seats, while at the same time that they end up losing places we thought would always vote Labour, like Blythe Valley.
Katie, is Rebecca Long-Bailey suffering from the fact that she's seen as a continuity Corbyn candidate, in that no one seems to be putting her down as a second preference candidate? Today we found out that GMB, the union that backed Lisa Nandy earlier this week, has urged its members to vote for Keir Starmer as a second preference.
So I think with certain unions, I don't think it's that surprising they haven't put Rebecca Long-Bailey down. I think that in terms of her issues, I feel like my contribution to the podcast today is I spoke to someone from Labour in the pub. But I do get the sense that one of the issues Rebecca Long-Bailey is having is she's just so obviously continuity Corbyn, to the point that lots of people who agreed with Corbynomics, agreed with the direction Jeremy Corbyn was going in, to find it a little bit difficult to go straight to her because they've got to concede something. So one person who is benefiting from that is Lisa Nandy, because she is seen as soft left. And therefore, I think that there are definitely some, in terms of, I think, Corbynite supporters who find it, who say, well, Rebecca Long-Bailey's continuity, but I like what Lisa Nandy's about, and that she's you know, a soft left MP. I like her voting record. I'm going to plump for her, because it's suggesting you've had some reflection, but you're not moving too far away, I suppose, from your core values. So I think that's one of the issues from her in this. And there have been lots of examples of that. I mean, when she gave Jeremy Corbyn 10 out of 10 as Labour leader, I don't think she's helped herself here. I think that she actually needed to be a bit more critical of Jeremy Corbyn than she has, because people had already banked that she was close to Jeremy Corbyn. You know, that is known, given her role, given how prominent she was in the election campaign, someone they trust. I think that she had to work to say, yes, I am, but here are the ways I'm different.
Mm.
And she hasn't. And now she does give the odd interview saying how different she will be.
Yeah.
But I'm struggling right now to... But I also think one of the things we're going to find out is, what is the power of momentum? Because her launch event was pretty slick, and you can see kind of using momentum fonts and graphics. She has the pro-Corbyn grassroots group behind her. Is the fact that as this contest goes on, you're going to have momentum messaging all their campaign groups using their social media presence, which is impressive, is that going to have an impact which could give Keir Starmer some issues? And I think on social media, it's really easy to be dismissive of Labour's social media output given the general election. They had the most viral videos, but ultimately, the Tories had a clear result there, but the Tories had a very strong social media game too, which is very focused.
Mm.
I think that in terms of the Labour membership, you do get the impression that actually, if momentum and their successful efforts were going to yield results, this would be it. This seems to be the point where actually a lot of the people who will be voting will be people who are online and, you know, operating and stuff in that sense.
James, today also the US has formally announced that Anne Sokoulis, the diplomat's wife who ran over Harry Dunn last year, will not be returning to the UK because she has diplomatic immunity. Is this going to be an issue that's going to run and run in a year when we're negotiating a trade deal with America?
I think given the importance that the US puts on diplomatic immunity, it was fairly predictable that they would say that she would not return. I think it is a difficulty for the government. I mean, the government line has been kind of noticeably tough on this, because that there is a question. I don't think this was what diplomatic immunity was designed to deal with. Diplomatic immunity is designed to prevent you from being arrested, essentially, for representing your country overseas. It's not designed for people who drive the wrong, you know, on the wrong side of the road. Obviously, justice is not going to be done in this case. I mean, we will see here the government take a kind of... the government are going to carry on taking a kind of robust position. But, you know, they can't... Ultimately, the US will not be prepared to give her up. And so it will just be stuck. And it is obviously very sad. I think there is a kind of challenge now in relation to this particular base. I mean, there is a challenge about how far this diplomatic immunity extends. You know, I mean, is it appropriate that people who are the family members of people posted there have it? I mean, that will become a subject of discussion.
And Katie, at this juncture, for something like this to happen, but also, you know, Trump's stronger assertiveness on the tech taxes and on Huawei, you know, is this a sign of, you know, post-Brexit relations, as it were? You know, now that we've left the EU, is America really going to be the friend that we want it to be?
I think there is a tendency sometimes to define every international relationship and decision through the prism of Brexit. And clearly it does affect things, but there are issues which, you know, do go beyond perhaps a Brexit trade deal and how you would best butter up the US side. And I also think that this government doesn't want to be seen as Donald Trump's poodle. And I also think if you just look at the record of governments trying to win Donald Trump's support on issues, Macron, several times, you know, it was written at one point that he had a wonderful, you know, bromance with Donald Trump, and yet there was very little in policy evidence to suggest that actually brought much to fruition. And if anything, in the cover piece in this week's Spectator this week, it suggests that now Macron is having to go through Boris Johnson. So I don't think that the Boris Johnson and his team are worried about ruffling a few feathers of relationship with America. I think that on this, they've even went strong. But I do think this, with this request, I mean, really no one actually thought the US were going to turn around and say, we are sending that person back. So you could accuse the UK government of perhaps going through the motions to try and suggest to the family they are doing something. Perhaps that's what they needed to do, because if not, the family said, why aren't you even trying? But I think there was a low expectation on both sides that this was actually going to yield results here. I don't think this is going to be what breaks the relationship. I think that if you're looking at probably the more significant issues, the Huawei decision, which is coming up, I think has the most scope to cause issues, because America have lobbied the UK government so hard on it. But the issue is the UK government ultimately think that if the US has such strong opposition to Huawei and having a role in the UK's 5G network, the US needs to help come up with solutions to it. And the US don't think they should. They think that ultimately this is on the UK, and why don't they try and do something here in our own country? And I think that tension, I think, is a much bigger issue. But broadly speaking, I think that there is a sense that they can actually just have dialogue and just see where it ends, because when you just try and do everything to please Donald Trump, you're only ever one tweet away from going a bit wrong anyway.
I also think that the broader challenge for the US-UK relationship is this question of how to handle China. Trump is obviously at the sharp end of this, but this is a broader change in US attitude to regard China as a strategic competitor. How does the UK handle that new US attitude towards China? I mean, it's a very, very difficult question. So I think you see the US beginning to think about China in the way that it did about the Soviet Union in the 40s and 50s, you know, the Kennan X memo. I think you've written about this in the magazine, Cindy, that this shift towards viewing China as in a kind of almost as a kind of second Cold War. And you know, the UK is not quite in that place. And I think there's also another difference, which is, you know, the Soviet Union was never part of the global, the Western economic system in the way that China is. And so I think the UK is conflicted between China's role in the economy, potential importance for China of a city of London, and trying to work out how to walk that tightrope is going to be very difficult. And we've seen, you know, the two Conservative governments we've had before Boris Johnson have had very different attitudes to that. You know, the Cameron Osborne approach was essentially to be China's best friend in the West. That, you know, if being Greeks to the Americans, Romans had basically got bought the UK another kind of half century of the global top table, being China's guide to the West could buy another half century. You know, Theresa May then took a very different, far more securocrat, far more concerned about what China was up to attitude. I suspect Boris Johnson will end up being somewhere between those two poles.
Mm-hmm. And as well as Huawei, we're going to see that this year with the trade negotiations with America. I think in NAFTA 2.0 that America's just signed with Canada and Mexico, there was an article in there, a so-called poison pill article, where if either Canada or Mexico sign a free trade deal with China, then that NAFTA 2.0 will be terminated with America. So we might be, something like that might come up for us as well. James and Katie, thanks very much. And we talked a lot about the Labour leadership in this episode. And to hear more about the Labour leadership, why not check out our weekly podcast, The Edition, where Isabel Hardman speaks to James Forsyth and former Labour MP for Ashfield, Gloria DiPiero, about the Labour leadership as well. So just go to Spectator Radio or search for The Edition on your podcast provider. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.